Shri Krishna, Jai Prabhupada Jaya, Prabhupada Jaya, Prabhupada
Jaya, Prabhupada Jaya, Prabhupada Jaya, Prabhupada Jaya,
Jaya Radha, Govinda Radha, Govinda Radha,
Jaya Radha, Govinda Radha, Govinda Radha,
Jaya Radha, Madhava Radha, Madhava His Divine Grace is Sri Bhakti Vedanta Swami Prabhupada. His confounder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Om Vishnupada Paramahamsa Parayava Jagacharya Astoria Satya Sri Srimad Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Swami Prabhupada Ki Ananta Gaur Vaishnavi Ki
Jai
Nam Acharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki
Jai
Pramsakaho, Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Sri Advaita Gadadhara, Sri Vasudeva Gaura Bhakta Vrindaki, Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gopi Gopinath, Shyamakunda Radha Kunda, Giri Govardhan Ki, Vrindavan Dham Ki, Mayapur Dham Ki, Unamai Ki, Gangamai Ki, Tulsi Devi Ki, Bhakti Devi Ki, Samaveda Bhakta Vrindaki, Go Premananda, all glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Govinda.
All glories to Sri Guru and Govinda.
Going to speak about the eternality of the soul and transmigration in the Bhagavad Gita. The translations or rough paraphrases of 2.12 and 2.13 of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, "Never was there a time when I did not exist or you. All these kings, and never in the future shall we cease to exist." And just as in boyhood the soul exists, and in youth and old age, so at the time of death, he takes another body. A sober person is not bewildered at such a change. But with great clarity, Krishna teaches this very early after becoming the spiritual master of Arjuna. And this forms the foundation for our lives in Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada used to call it the ABC, spiritual knowledge. And in our own, each of us probably remember, we can tell some incident or story how we came to accept it, either by reading the Bhagavad Gita or by talking with a devotee and thinking about it. We might think, however, that once you accept it, then it just grows stronger and stronger and stays throughout the life. But that's often not a fact. Sometimes we retreat or doubts come. We don't develop strong conviction and nishta. So Prabhupada used to regularly provoke a discussion about this with his disciples, sometimes on morning walks and other times. I remember being present, and on a number of occasions I would play the role of the foil to this teaching. So I can remember how it would go. Especially I remember transmigration of the soul. Prabhupada would say, so this is a perfectly clear instruction. How can there possibly be any objection to it? From boyhood to youth to old age, the self is present, so he will be present in the next life. What is the objection? So I would say that this example doesn't prove it doesn't prove that there's a, that it happens in the next life. It describes the change in this life and suggests that the thing could happen in the next life, but it doesn't. Oh, Prabhupada would say that it does prove by analogy. And I would say, but it's an analogy, I would say. I remember going over this one walk, particularly coming from the Schloss or castle in Germany, 1974. I said, it's an analogy, but I have no experience of it actually happening. So then Prabhupada switched the argument from the analogy of 2:14. He said, yes, what do you mean you don't have experience? Every night you have an experience when you dream. He said, you have an experience that you have one self, and then when you in the dream you have a particular self and you forget your one self, and then when you wake you have another self. So that's your experience. And I said, but that's not the experience that after death I'll have another body. And then if necessary, Prabhupada would put that argument aside. Yeah, almost any argument Prabhupada used, he used them like almost like weapons, ready to use another one if necessary. I'm not saying that I defeated Prabhupada, but he was in any of these arguments, but he was ready to use one after another, not just thinking that he was depending only on one. He was very dexterous to slippery my bodies and atheists. So then he said that anyway, Krishna says this, and Krishna is the greatest authority, so we accept it on Krishna's authority. And then either me or somebody else might speak up, understanding that Prabhupada was enjoying that lion-like play with the cubs, might speak up and say, but we don't accept Krishna. Then I kick on your face. you rascal, who are you who should I accept, Krishna or you? So then we would always be ready to think of something else, but we and then Prabhupada might get quite angry in the talk, although he had provoked it, and he would say, what other argument? Is there another argument? We would keep giving arguments, because you can always give some argument to say, well, I don't accept Krishna. But when Prabhupada started insulting you, then you started thinking about it. Well, is he insulting me or some person? you rascal. These are foolish ideas, he said. These are ridiculous ideas you are offering. He said, you are nonsense. Who are you? You might even stop walking and really look at you. And you thought, well, wait a minute, I better be careful. And which was really significant also, because at some point earlier, obviously we had become disciples, we had gone through the process of accepting it, now he was our guru, so it's one thing to play with him, but are we actually going to give up this faith that we had gathered? And so we too were faithful, not just Gyanis who had accepted it by some process of argumentation, and we didn't want to give up Prabhupada's goodwill toward us and the protection of himself and Krishna for having accepted the life of Krishna consciousness and faith in the eternal soul in the process of receiving it. So in a sense we would back off from the argument, but it might continue to go on within the mind. Let's look at the in brief the arguments, the way, in other words, rather than just teaching a child the soul is eternal, there are philosophical arguments why you should accept it, and the basic argument is that it's taught in the books of knowledge. And that's the way of learning, Prabhupada would explain. Everything has to be learned from books of knowledge, not by mental speculation, especially such a profound thing as what is the life within the body, what is the supreme... I'm speaking only about the eternality of the individual soul today, but of course you have to go beyond that to the supreme soul. So many topics that can only be understood from books of knowledge. Then why should we accept books of knowledge over other things? That's analyzed by teachers like Srila Jiva Goswami and others. So they say there are three kinds of evidence: pratyaksha, anumana, and shabda. Pratyaksha means direct. Direct evidence is not very good because our senses are not perfect. So what you see, what your senses, so defective. Seeing a little ball in the sky, you think it's the sun. But by knowledge of books, you understand it's a huge planet, and so on. Then aside from your senses, inductive knowledge, it may be like this, hypothesis. For instance, Darwin's theory says it may be like this, it may be like that. That's a perfect example, Darwin, because he, long ago, he took a voyage and collected different data and of rocks and fossils and impressions and so on, and then brought them back to the laboratory and then made theories about them. And from those, from the little bit, especially in those days, he probably couldn't collect very much. Remember, I read his book, it was called The Voyage of the Beagle, the name of his boat. He probably didn't collect very much. He didn't have a very scientific tools to study them, but he did a lot of mental speculating and decided that there was no God, and that there was an origin of the species by random selection and so on. Very interesting theories from the mind. It may be like this, it may be like that. So that's a kind of knowledge. But it's not science. It's a suggestion, it's not perfect. And then the third kind of knowledge, from authoritative sources, that is perfect. So that means that you just receive it and you don't add your speculation to it. Example it gives here is a radio station tells you what's going to be on the dial. But it's not just a radio station, it's a Shabda Brahma coming from perfect authorities of Shruti, the Vedas. Prabhupada says, this is, I'm reading from the introduction to Isopanishad, we have published Bhagavad Gita as it is because we accept Krishna as he is speaking. Whatever Krishna says, we accept. That's Krishna consciousness. It saves time. And then he uses two important terms, inductive and deductive knowledge, which is another way of going over this ground. inductive knowledge and deductive. From deductive, you accept that man is mortal. Your father says man is mortal. Your sister says man is mortal. Everyone says man is mortal. You do not experiment. You accept it as fact that man is mortal. If you want to research to find out whether man is mortal, you have to study each and every man. And you may come to think there may be some man who is not dying, but you have not seen him yet. That's inductive knowledge. Sanskrit is Adroha, is the descending process. Aroha is the ascending process. You've heard all this before. But still, you can learn this in so many bhakti shastra courses and so on. It's a formidable science. Academic scholars would say that the Vaishnava philosophy has a very good internal logic of its own, a good theology, but it's all internal. It's still based on a faith. And we would say, yes, but everything that is based on a faith process, we take this faith process, not another. And so the debate may continue about the eternality of the soul. I wrote an essay about this in this little book, Living with the Scriptures, and I called the essay Do or Die, because either you accept this, the Bhagavad Gita's teachings on Krishna's authority, or you can't go further. Do or die. In the spiritual, and you're free to accept it or not. But if you don't, then you can't go further. There's good reason to accept it, but still you have to accept it. And in the essay, the moment in the essay that I like the best, it's a human moment, is that it starts out telling how Prabhupada argued with a guy who came to the temple, who said that actually the self changes, not just the body, and how Prabhupada couldn't convince him, and after the lecture we couldn't convince him. But then there are those who do become convinced, and they're the devotees. And so, which is interesting, that some are convinced and some aren't. That subject is brought up in the Bhagavad Gita, I think it's 229. Some look on the soul as amazing, and some have to hearing about him, still can't understand. And Prabhupada says that it's due to pious activities in past lives or that one will understand, and it's almost like you're cursed from supernatural forces that you won't understand. But there are two divisions of people. So in this essay, I compare that challenger, who even Prabhupada couldn't convince, to a question and answer that I had with a devotee. And he was at. He said, "How do you accept that there is transmigration of the soul in the next life?" Advaita Das asked me. This was no formal inquiry in a lecture hall, nor was it a challenge so much, but a confidential personal encounter with an honest brother. We were walking through the streets of the Lower East Side on our way to an afternoon of chanting in Tompkins Square Park. Advaita was a new devotee. He wanted to know why I believed, and how he could believe in the soul. I replied in the same natural way that he had inquired, by giving an example which Srila Prabhupada had given. Just like the mother is the one to tell you who your father is, you can't speculate on your own. I said that you might remember an incident where you accepted how the soul is eternal. There's also a moment when for the first time we preach. That's an interesting moment. When somebody asks us like this, and then we hear ourselves almost repeating the philosophy with a little bit of conviction. Maybe we also hear how it's a little hollow, that there's lack of conviction, but there we are. Somebody's hearing from us, and we're speaking the philosophy. He had heard it before, but he knew it was meaningful. You mean because Swamiji and the Gita are saying so? Yes. Otherwise, how can anybody know? And that was that. We went to the park and chanted all afternoon. good. You have a tape recorder. I have a tape of Prabhupada 1966. I just want to see where the volume is in case I'm... Why is it going?
Okay. But my mind, my intelligence, cannot go so far. We say, perhaps, it may be, it was like this. So this is all mental. How we can say, now, the opposite party may say, how we can say, now we have got evidence from the basic literature. But the other party, they have no evidence. They are simply speculations. We can give some evidence. The data are accepted by acharyas, and they are following, and they are getting the result. So therefore, Suti Pramana. Suti Pramana, there are three kinds of evidences. out of that, Suti Pramana, evidence from higher authority, that is the first class evidence. What are those evidence? Pratyaksha, Itujya and Suti. Pratyaksha means direct perception. Direct perception, that is evidence. People with poor fund of knowledge, they want direct perception of everything. But that is not possible. Direct perception of everything is not possible. Therefore, aitijya. Aitijya, aitijya means historical. Historical. Parampara. Hearing. Traditional. The next first class evidence is Suti. Suti means to hear from the authority. That is Suti. Just like the example we have several times cited here, that the evidence, who is my father, that evidence is to hear from my mother. That's all. There is no other evidence. The mother says, this is your father, he is your father. This is Suti, hearing from the mother authority. And we have no other authority to understand Father. Similarly, we have to understand our Supreme Father from the Suti Mother, Vedic Mother. Mother, Vedic Mother. We have to accept Vedas as Mother. Suti.
So, from time to time, it may be a little embarrassing, maybe to our Western mindset, that we use this process, since it's so much not used. But we shouldn't be, and we should put it forward whenever necessary, and to ourselves, that this is why we have knowledge of the soul as eternal, and the transmigration of the soul. So, this beginning instruction is the foundation that was taught by Prabhupada throughout his lecturing, great emphasis, and of course he would bring it up to bhakti. But if people don't even accept that the soul is eternal, then they can't go further. I like to tell an incident of Prabhupada telling me about the transmigration, because it's in this topic, but also it was very late in his life, and it was maybe the last quality attention that he gave me individually that I can remember, or one of them. It was at the Mayapur Festival, 1977, and the reason he gave me his attention, I think, is because of a couple of reasons. One, I had just been with him for a month, every month a different GBC man stayed with Prabhupada as his secretary, and then they would change so that he got training. So I had just been there while he was in Bhubaneswar and for 2 weeks, and then 2 weeks while he was in Calcutta and Mayapur. Then Tamal Krishna Maharaj had taken over, and he would stay in that position until the end of Prabhupada's life, which was the end of 1977. And another reason Prabhupada called me in was that at the GBC meetings in 1977, I was reinstated to be the editor-in-chief of Back to Godhead, and there was a dissatisfaction among the leaders in society that the magazine was getting watered down and that it should preach more strongly and philosophically. So Prabhupada, hearing this complaint, he accepted this and he wanted the magazine to do like that. But anyway, so there we were all in Mayapur with Prabhupada, and there were hundreds of devotees, and it was very early in the morning after Mangalarti. We were chanting japa, and Prabhupada was in his room. Hari Sori was his secretary, his servant, but he used to have guards and devotees who ran errands who would sort of hang around just outside Prabhupada's room. Those of you who know Mayapur, that used to be the main building. Now it's just dwarfed by other buildings. In the second or third floor, I don't remember which, off the main stairway, you turn left and there is his little room with the low desk. So outside that room, the guards would be. So one of them was sent to get me, where I was, and he said, Prabhupada wants to see you. So I went there, and in his room he was sitting, and he just had one little light on. And he said, I've just been dictating in the Bhagavat this morning, and I wanted you to hear what it is. He said, why don't people accept this transmigration of the soul? He was talking about their failure to do so, and that it is so convincing. So I just agreed with him that they were very dull, and that's why they didn't. So he said, it is so perfect, and so it puts everything into place and gives us a direction how to live our life. You remember Prabhupada also saying that because people in India, still today, although it's decaying, they so much accept this that it kind of governs their behavior from becoming really savagely degraded, because they have an idea that the present situation is determined by the past life and the next life is going to be determined by the present life because of the transmigration of the soul. But without that, then all hell breaks loose. Only one life, the soul is not eternal. There's nothing but sense gratification, or in the absence of it, vicious acts, and to get it. So, and then those who try for respect, it's not based on real knowledge. It's something partial of the heart, which is perhaps not enough. Anyway, Prabhupada was talking about that, and then he played the tape for me, and it was like the poor production, the poor reproduction, not like a lecture, but of a dictation tape. And what he was dictating at that time, it was the 10th canto, it was a speech. Of course, throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam, there are many speeches about transmigration and the souls being eternal by Narada and others when it's necessary. Well, this was a speech by Vasudeva to Kamsa, when Kamsa wanted to kill Devaki. It's about transmigration. So he played it, and it had different analogies there about the caterpillar changing from one branch to another when he's ready to go from one branch to another, different things like that. Very good section. And then he said, write vigorous articles on this and try to convince people. So I was very thrilled to be called in and try to take it to heart. But assuming that we accept this as our religious doctrine, theoretically, we still have to see how much it really changes our life. What if it doesn't change your life at all? That if on a questionnaire you answer and turn out to be one of those rather small percentage, or perhaps it's a growing percentage, probably thanks to the New Age, that do you believe in the transmigration of the soul? That yes, I certainly do. But does it change your life, and in what ways does it? We have to ask that question. And in the Bhagavad Gita, there's an answer given right away in the next verse, in 2:14. Krishna says, or I take it that way, if you say that 2:12 says that we're all eternal individual souls, 2:13 says, and we transmigrate, that is, if we're not perfect in one life, we have to take another body. The eternal soul never dies. That 14 speaks of how to live in this situation. O son of Kunti, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception, O scion of Bharata, and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. Prabhupada gives examples in his purport of how we have to tolerate material conditions and not give up our religious duties. A wife has to cook in the kitchen even when it's very hot, and a person who follows Brahminical principles has to take a bath, which may be very cold, they don't have hot water, even in the winter. You can't give it up. So so if you believe that the soul is eternal, then you have to more and more try to act that way. We can't do it 100%. We can't just ignore that we have a body that grieves, that needs comforts. And we've been talking of so many also psychological expressions and satisfactions that it needs. But they can't abandon the religious principle that the eternal soul has to be emphasized. Self-realization is the important part of life. That's the very crucial matter here in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna raises high-minded principles that should be followed rather than killing people on the battlefield, social and religious considerations. But Krishna says, higher than that is what is of interest to the soul. So that's what it means. That's one way of explaining what it means to be Krishna conscious, that you give up material interests and favor spiritual interests even when it's inconvenient, when it's a little cold or when it's a little hot, to do so. Of course, it's not so difficult in this age, thanks to Lord Chaitanya and Srila Prabhupada, but we should always be asking ourselves about this. Is this in the interest of my eternal goal, of my eternal nature? It would seem to me this is one way to prove that we understand this teaching and we live by it. And if a devotee by name doesn't live accordingly, then doesn't really have self-realization. Now, as I said, this is only the beginning. In fact, if we were to stop here in the philosophy, we could equal just Brahman realization, to understand there's a soul, and to be open to the misconception that the soul and the supreme soul are everything. You have to go on to understand the soul is the eternal servant of the supreme. But self-realization without God realization, it can't go without God realization, and God realization can't go without self-realization. They go together. So why don't we have some discussion? I left a lot of time. I was thinking of a couple of points. I mentioned earlier. Of course, you can ask me any questions. I can try to answer. But also, if you can preface it, or instead of just a question, make a comment about how you came to accept this, which is a kind of leap of faith, the transmigration of the soul, as Prabhupada and Krishna teach it. And then also, as I was saying, it doesn't always just progress and progress and progress and get stronger. Can you tell any tests, recent tests to your living this philosophy, to living the life of the soul, where it was like a choice, leave the life of the body or leave the life of the soul? They come in conflict sometimes. You know, like the life of the body says to the wife, I don't want to go in and cook. Well, at least it's religion in that example. And the life of religion says you must go in and cook. But there are other examples that are similar, that the life of the body says something opposite, the desire of the soul. When you think of recent tests, that would benefit us to hear. We can have a discussion. Any brave soul on the platform? See how brave your soul
always
is.
Always live on the platform of the soul.
Just in relation, there's some point you made earlier, you said that the knowledge comes from previous lives, and if you perform pious activities in previous lives, then by some I can't remember how you put it.
Supernatural influence or something.
Influence. Then this thing will come automatically. I remember when I first came in contact with the devotees, Samba actually was the first devotee kind of I met. And for some reason, he thought the best way to preach for me was to show me the fifth canto of Hellish Planets. You know, it's like, this is what will happen, you know. And all that was the first kind of experience I'd had of any of the books or the knowledge, really. And for some reason, when I saw these pictures, I knew it was true. Hmm. I didn't want to, like... every natural instinct in me is like trying to reject it, because, you know, obviously my it kind of went against all my lifestyle. And for some reason, this, as you say, this supernatural power of influence was there, and I just knew that all this was completely true.
Yeah, that reminds me, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the sixth chapter, Krishna says that if the soul doesn't make perfection, he has to come back, and then he's born in a family which is advantageous to further devotional service, and then he's attracted to the devotional principles almost without his desiring it. And it sounds like one of those experiences, like almost like a calling, either very striking or faintly, but very definite. understanding the soul and the transmigration of the soul by these persons. It's not so scientific. But it's a kind of mounting empirical evidence that people have had past lives, and they can, under certain conditions like hypnosis, they can remember them again. And the reverse is true, that you will have future lives.
The two points that you're talking about, say something to the first point and the second point. Mm. First point, that I can remember distinctly accepting what that Prabhupada was a very saintly person. When I had Patrick, it was quite handy. He was reading the books and he was explaining Krishna consciousness.
He got it first?
Yeah. And I can't remember actually accepting, oh yes, now this reincarnation, this makes sense, or this transmigration makes sense. It was like, it's almost like I accepted this person is the wisest person I've ever met. So I had this impetus to accept what he had said and almost defend it without even, you know, realizing it, because I thought that, you know, maybe because I was a bit of a rebel or whatever, I now had a real cause that nobody else could defeat. And so it was almost like, you know, I was tricked into it. And all those things that may be very difficult to understand for some people, by the acceptance of Prabhupada, became very easy. They weren't difficult. But the other point that...
I think a lot of people came in that way because accepting Prabhupada. Yeah.
And the other point that we were talking about last night at the back of the virtual meeting, that it's almost like everything we do has the potential to be either spiritual or material. You know, and the challenge is not necessarily to give up even the things that we may do naturally for our body. An act of instruction. Prabhupada say we're striving for big cars or big buildings or big, you know, that we may have a certain nature that isn't readily usable, but it can be. And I think the point was made by someone that actually we don't have a choice to change ourselves. You know, it's not that we have to change everything, but the challenge is to make it Krishna conscious.
Yeah.
So so it was a relief for me in one sense, because I would see a lot of the things that I do are pertaining to the body, because that's my conditioning.
Yeah.
But I know they're not good for me, but I can't give them up.
Yeah.
But maybe I can, with expert guidance or knowledge, I can change them.
Yeah. So it can be turned into activities that are good for self-realization. As you say, you don't have a choice. If living the life of the soul means to give up your very nature, then you couldn't do it. For example, I've been hearing Prabhupada on these 66 tapes talk about sacrifice. He was saying that in former ages they did these other sacrifices, and he kept saying how they're impossible now. They're impossible. The only one that's possible is chanting Hare Krishna. So sacrifice is a way of realizing self-realization, and it's the only way that we can do because of our limited abilities. Then in that case, very, very gratefully take to the means that are given to us with it, and use our propensities and abilities happily in Krishna's service. Otherwise we just get depressed at our inabilities. And if we're supposed to be preachers also, and we just go around, you know, excluding people and making them depressed that they can't follow it, then what's the use? We should be able to, without changing the philosophy, show people that it's very easy to practice Krishna consciousness, and they can do so. Others? Yeah.
Says, like, how can people accept this transformation? of eternality. Like, when I was a child, I used to meditate on the world being, you know, between the universe and the sky. The Sunday school, we were taught the world is eternal. You know, the world is eternal. So I couldn't kind of remember the cry as a child, thinking, it goes on and on and on. It freaked me out, you know, it goes on and on and on. And I'd lie there saying, and on and on and on. you know, but they didn't teach that we, the spirits, all were eternal. And then, you know, we may get more indication as we grow older. And then when finally we made a devotee, it's like the jigsaw, like piece of the jigsaw is slotted in, and we have a clear understanding of what's gone before.
Yeah, not asked to meditate on some almost impossible metaphysical thing that is not really explained properly.
For a child's brain, it's very bewildering when they're telling that, but don't say anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so wonderful. How the material, you say the world is eternal, but how actually the worlds are not eternal. They exist for a long, long time, and then they're destroyed, and then they're created again. And the souls continue to evolve in them. And then there's a spiritual world, however, that doesn't get destroyed. And when the souls get released, they go there. Everything is explained. If you accept the Shabda Brahma, then somebody will tell you this. Why there's suffering, karma, and transmigration. And even if you can't, and then if partly is something you say, well, I just can't understand it, I can't understand why it would be so, why God would do that, then you just accept with trust in Krishna, and Krishna knows, and you don't know. Prabhupada would, yeah, he could see it as being supremely reasonable and satisfying and easy to practice. Why don't they take to it?
See ourselves using it, and have a course, and the understanding for a devotee that we accept it. It's not until we are confronted with having to practice it that suddenly you see how quickly our acceptance is like. It's very shallow, and it's just a funny little example. The other day in college, we had a photograph to take, and just a real sponsorship, so I had a nice, jazzy, good, fun photographs. And beforehand, I was like, photograph, like, and I just stand there and don't get into it or get involved. But the photograph I was in, I got something completely wrong. And I had to step out and, oh God, I was flying all over the place, upset, and like, oh, I got it wrong, it's not fair, I meant to be in there, well, I just, and I like, took a few seconds to kind of step back and laugh at myself, and I immediately, my so-called coolness had been up and so bothered about how I looked in the photograph was like completely thrown away, and I was all upset that I got, that I looked so wrong, I wasn't allowed in, but I consoled myself by thinking that I could laugh at myself quite quickly afterwards. So I see my initial reaction was, I was far from being like, not convinced I'm a soul, not this present material form. But then my devotee side kind of stepped in a few minutes later. Kind of, and my thing is how long the delay occurred between my first reaction and then my more considered and conscious and knowledgeable reaction. I could laugh at myself, and how quickly I lost my so-called haughty just off the platform.
Yeah, you brought up one kind of something more than an intellectual doubt. I was talking about how we might go backwards in our early assumptions of belief in the soul. So one way you might have some recurring intellectual doubt. Well, how can the soul really be eternal? Nowadays, nobody says that. That's what's called an intellectual doubt. But the other is a doubt of, like an existential doubt, that you don't act on that platform. And that's, I guess that's a more important one, is to be able to, when there is difficulty, as in verse 2:14, much as Sparsha's Tukundiya, when there's any difficulty, to be able to act on the platform of the soul and think, I'm not this body, it's all right. My real values, my real existence are not affected here. So, we may not... I heard Prabhupada keep using this word, atmarati, atmarati. The person who is self-satisfied, he doesn't get disturbed either for sense gratification or sense disturbance, because he's just satisfied in the self, and therefore when there's any body lacking, he's not disturbed. He gave extreme examples of Sukadeva Goswami, who was walking naked, and he wasn't attracted to the women, and they weren't attracted to him. And then that was a potential attraction. And then potential distress, he gave the example of this six Goswamis who gave up all their aristocratic life and just lived under a different tree each night because they were atmarati. So, that's certainly a test. If we try to dovetail all our propensities, but when something doesn't go our way, we have the solace that, well, Prabhupada has taught and Krishna has taught that we're spirit, soul, and so I haven't lost out on that account. Then we'll have to turn back to a verse like this, and if it means nothing to us, there's one verse in the Bhagavatam that says, if at the time of death, you know, I forget exactly, but if at the time of death these teachings don't give you solace, then of what good is all this scholarship been? Vedic scholarship. If you're completely disturbed by the bodily condition, you can't take solace in the fact that, well, I'm a soul, and I'm going somewhere in the next life, and I'll have another chance to practice devotional service. Should give us some peace of mind. And I must let go now, and I must go. And I'll go where Krishna is going to take me. That's all based on knowledge of the eternal self. And we don't know what it's like to die. But a lot of devotees have seen the passing away of somebody and have tried to help them pass away, and have seen either that they do it successfully or not, and have tried to assure them that they're going, that they're under higher authority. And that their self will continue. That's the real test.
Another aspect of that, of understanding about transmigration and so on. I know at the start, like, I accepted a lot of that quite, you know, readily, because he was pointing out, accepting the philosophy was something that I understood was the highest. But recently, I've been thinking a lot that I accepted things a bit too quickly. I was actually, I saw a program recently, and this is some program about the Jews being killed in the Second World War, and actually I wrote about it a little while later, and it was very, very emotional for me to write about it, and I found that I needed to get more into those sort of things rather than, in one sense, to, at the end of it, I you know, the philosophy was very, you know, it was good for me at the end, but it was like it was just too quick acceptance of the philosophy rather than actually experience the sort of things that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we may have assumed to have passed through all states to higher levels of of self-realization, where one is undisturbed. And then later, that's uncovered. It doesn't make the philosophy false, but it's exposed that I don't understand the philosophy. And I may have to face, come to grips with the emotions that I went through in some way or another. Examples of that are people prematurely giving up different family relationships and joining ISKCON, things like that, or giving up different interests and pursuits. But again, it's not that they accepted the wrong philosophy, they just did it kind of backwards or. So what was your conclusion? Did you feel resentful of something, or?
I got this conclusion that there was several things that were on that level as well, which I just rejected very quickly without actually, you know, really understanding the whole area there. And I think I had a. The writing was sort of the bit of writing that I did about it was sort of good for me, because I did express a little bit of resentment and stuff, and I think I sort of got through it by doing that.
We might resent persons or teachers who brought us prematurely through the and said, "Oh, you can leave all that. That's all sentimental." And, those people had to die anyway. It was their karma or something like that. Rushed you through. Stages in your own life, and then you had to go back, and so you resent. Why did they do that?
There's another conversation actually that I think was at this last session as well, which you mentioned at the start. I remember this. It was between Professor Durkheim and Sri Prabhupada, and you highlighted it on one tape that was made a couple of years ago as well, whereby he wanted to find out how he could make his students actually feel. And experience spiritual life, and but Prabhupada, you were saying, Prabhupada kept on insisting on, you know, on the philosophy, and then suddenly, like a flash, he actually understood what Prabhupada was saying, and I was thinking about that quite a lot as well, because sometimes I think that we don't feel enough. Not I sort of like fall over to the side of Professor Durkheim sometimes, in that sense, but at the same, you know, when it comes. You know, keeping on going further and further and further, then I can also sort of like a flash, and you know, sometimes I can see, you know, Prabhupada's that understanding of philosophy that just doesn't get to the finish line, actually is the only answer as well.
Intelligent man's or an intelligent person's theology, Krishna consciousness. I remember liking the concept that Krishna consciousness is a science of God, And in that sense, it can help other religions, but it's an educated version of God consciousness, which can really be a sort of an infantile, sentimental thing without really good explanations. But Krishna consciousness is an educated version of understanding God and teaching God. And certainly the transmigration of the soul and nature of the soul is at the beginning of it. And Krishna, he so brilliantly distinguishes himself from almost all world spiritual literature right in those verses. He just starts right out. He says things that you don't really find anywhere else. And we should be appreciative of that, of these early verses in Bhagavad Gita. Although we must move on to bhakti, he really sets the ground so wonderfully and thus shows himself to be Bhagavan. And you were saying more? Recent tests?
Yeah,
well, I remember actually right at that time, you know, coming home after the lectures and thinking, okay, that explains a lot of things on a broad scale, but then what do we, you know, when the first lecture was on and on.
Yeah, they're like, if you ask yourself, what is the soul? In one sense, I have to say in all humility, I really don't know. I have no feeling of myself as a soul. Prabhupada says, we just accept it because the books say so, although it's a fact by perception. That's stated in one, that we have no way of knowing the soul except by hearing from authority, although it is a fact by perception. I take that a fact by perception to mean this example of consciousness, that it's spread throughout the body by consciousness. You pinch yourself, that's a proof that the soul is in the body. So that's one example of the soul. There are some others, like when you see a dead person, then you know the person is gone, although the body is there. But they don't really tell us very much. In one sense, to really feel that you're a soul is something that I can't say that I understand. But the more and more faith I have in the books, that's a kind of knowledge, certainly. But one has to admit humbly, I really don't have self-realization. I don't have realization of myself as a soul, but I believe it. That's a kind of going back, too. Manu mentioned an emotional going back to a whole different side of our experience and character, owning up. But another going back is even to the spiritual realization and admitting I don't know what the soul is. And then there's Krishna. The deity, Krishna in the holy name. And in one sense he appears more tangible than this spark that is sometimes just depicted in the painting or I saw it the other night in the Abhay video. There was a spark appeared in somebody's chest. So, what is this spark? 1/10,000th the proportion of the hair. Krishna's got a nice form and everything already. But we couldn't see Krishna unless we had a soul. So, they go together. By Krishna's grace, we have a self by which we can chant and see him and serve him. We have Vaishnavas, we have all these relationships in bhakti. Anyone else? One more, maybe? Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada.
Jai.